The Man in the Brown Suit, Agatha Christie, Chapter 16. I got an opportunity of tackling Colonel Race on the following morning. The auction of the sweep had just been concluded, and we walked up and down the deck together. "How's the gypsy this morning? Longing for land and her caravan?" I shook my head. "Now that the sea's behaving so nicely, I feel I should like to stay on it forever and ever."
"What enthusiasm!"
"Well, isn't it lovely this morning?" We leant together over the rail. It was a glassy calm. The sea looked as though it had been oiled. There were great patches of color in it. Blue, pale green, emerald, purple, and deep orange. Like a cubist picture. There was an occasional flash of silver that showed the flying fish. The air was moist and warm, almost sticky. Its breath was like a perfumed caress.
"That was a very interesting story you told us last night," I said, breaking the silence.
"Which one?"
"The one about the diamonds."
"I believe women are always interested in diamonds."
"Of course we are. By the way, what became of the other young man? You said there were two of them."
"Young Lucas? Well, of course they couldn't prosecute one without the other, so he went scot-free too."
"And what happened to him? Eventually, I mean. Does anyone know?"
Colonel Race was looking straight ahead of him out to sea. His face was as devoid of expression as a mask, but I had an idea that he didn't like my questions. Nevertheless, he replied readily enough. "He went to the war and acquitted himself bravely. He was reported missing and wounded, believed killed."
That told me what I wanted to know. I asked no more, but more than ever I wondered how much Colonel Race knew. The part he was playing in all this puzzled me.
One other thing I did. That was to interview the night steward. With a little financial encouragement, I soon got him to talk.
"The lady wasn't frightened, was she, miss?"
"It seemed a harmless sort of joke. A bet, or so I understood." I got it all out of him, little by little. On the voyage from Cape Town to England, one of the passengers had handed him a roll of films with instructions that they were to be dropped onto the bunk in cabin 71 at 1 a.m. on January 22nd on the outward journey. A lady would be occupying the cabin, and the affair was described as a bet. I gathered that the steward had been liberally paid for his part in the transaction. The lady's name had not been mentioned. Of course, as Mrs. Blair went straight into cabin 71, interviewing the purser as she got on board, it never occurred to the steward that she was not the lady in question. The name of the passenger who had arranged the transaction was Carton, and his description tallied exactly with that of the man killed on the tube. So one mystery, at all events, was cleared up, and the diamonds were obviously the key to the whole situation. Those last days on the Kilmorden seemed to pass very quickly. As we drew nearer and nearer to Cape Town, I was forced to consider carefully my future plans. There were so many people I wanted to keep an eye on. Mr. Chichester, Sir Eustace and his secretary, and, yes, Colonel Race. What was I to do about it? Naturally, it was Chichester who had first claim on my attention. Indeed, I was on the point of reluctantly dismissing Sir Eustace and Mr. Paget from their position of suspicious characters when a chance conversation awakened fresh doubts in my mind. I had not forgotten Mr. Paget's incomprehensible emotion at the mention of Florence. On the last evening on board, we were all sitting on deck, and Sir Eustace addressed a perfectly innocent question to his secretary. I forget exactly what it was, something to do with railway delays in Italy, but at once I noticed that Mr. Paget was displaying the same uneasiness which had caught my attention before. When Sir Eustace claimed Mrs. Blair for a dance, I quickly moved into the chair next to the secretary. I was determined to get to the bottom of the matter.
"I have always longed to go to Italy," I said, "and especially to Florence. Didn't you enjoy it very much there?"
"Indeed I did, Miss Bedingfeld. If you will excuse me, there's some correspondence of Sir Eustace's that—" I took hold of him firmly by his coat sleeve.
"Oh, you mustn't run away," I cried with the skittish accent of an elderly dowager. "I'm sure Sir Eustace wouldn't like you to leave me all alone with no one to talk to. You never seem to want to talk about Florence. Oh, Mr. Paget, I believe you have a guilty secret."
I still had my hand on his arm, and I could feel the sudden start he gave.
"Not at all, Miss Bedingfeld, not at all," he said earnestly. "I should be only too delighted to tell you all about it, but there really are some cables—"
"Oh, Mr. Paget, what a thin pretense. I shall tell Sir Eustace." I got no further. He gave another jump. The man's nerves seemed in a shocking state.
"What is it you want to know?"
The resigned martyrdom of his tone made me smile inwardly.
"Oh, everything. The pictures, the olive trees."
I paused, rather at a loss myself.
"I suppose you speak Italian," I resumed.
"Not a word, unfortunately. But of course with hall porters and, guides."
"Exactly," I hastened to reply. "And which was your favorite picture?"
"The Madonna, Raphael, you know."
"Dear old Florence," I murmured sentimentally. "So picturesque on the banks of the Arno. A beautiful river. And the Duomo. You remember the Duomo?"
"Of course, of course."
"Another beautiful river, is it not?" I hazarded. "Almost more beautiful than the Arno."
"Decidedly so, I should say."
Emboldened by the success of my little trap, I proceeded further. But there was little room for doubt. Mr. Paget delivered himself into my hands with every word he uttered. The man had never been in Florence in his life. But if not in Florence, where had he been? In England? Actually, in England at the time of the Mill House mystery? I decided on a bold step. "The curious thing is," I said, "that I fancied I'd seen you somewhere before. But I must be mistaken, since you were in Florence at the time, and yet—" I studied him frankly. There was a hunted look in his eyes. He passed his tongue over his dry lips.
Where?
"Did I think I'd seen you?" I finished for him. "At Marlowe. You know Marlowe. Why, of course, how stupid of me. Sir Eustace has a house there." But with an incoherent muttered excuse, my victim rose and fled. That night I invaded Suzanne's cabin, alight with excitement. "You see, Suzanne," I urged as I finished my tale, "he was in England, in Marlowe, at the time of the murder. Are you so sure now that the man in the brown suit is guilty?"
"I'm sure of one thing," said Suzanne, twinkling unexpectedly.
"What's that?"
"That the man in the brown suit is better looking than poor Mr. Paget."
"No, Anne, don't get cross. I was only teasing. Sit down here. Joking apart, I think you've made a very important discovery. Up till now, we've considered Paget as having an alibi. Now we know he hasn't."
"Exactly," I said. "We must keep an eye on him."
"As well as everybody else," she said ruefully. "Well, that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. That and finance. No, don't stick your nose in the air. I know you're absurdly proud and independent, but you've got to listen to horse sense over this. We're partners. I wouldn't offer you a penny because I liked you, or because you're a friendless girl. What I want is a thrill, and I'm prepared to pay for it. We're going into this together, regardless of expense. To begin with, you'll come with me to the Mount Nelson Hotel at my expense, and we'll plan out our campaign." We argued the point. In the end, I gave in. But I didn't like it. I wanted to do the thing on my own. "That's settled," said Suzanne at last, getting up and stretching herself with a big yawn. "I'm exhausted with my own eloquence. Now then, let us discuss our victims. Mr. Chichester is going on to Durban. Sir Eustace is going to the Mount Nelson Hotel in Cape Town, and then up to Rhodesia. He's going to have a private car on the railway, and in a moment of expansion, after his fourth glass of champagne the other night, he offered me a place in it. I dare say he didn't really mean it, but all the same, he can't very well back out if I hold him to it." "Good," I approved. "You keep an eye on Sir Eustace and Paget, and I take on Chichester. But what about Colonel Race?" Suzanne looked at me queerly. "Anne, you can't possibly suspect..." "I do. I suspect everybody. I'm in the mood when one looks round for the most unlikely person." "Colonel Race is going to Rhodesia, too," said Suzanne thoughtfully. "If we could arrange for Sir Eustace to invite him also..." "You can manage it. You can manage anything." "I love butter," purred Suzanne. We parted on the understanding that Suzanne should employ her talents to the best advantage. I felt too excited to go to bed immediately. It was my last night on board. Early tomorrow morning, we should be in Table Bay. I slipped up on deck. The breeze was fresh and cool. The boat was rolling a little in the choppy sea. The decks were dark and deserted. It was after midnight. I leaned over the rail, watching the phosphorescent trail of foam. Ahead of us lay Africa. We were rushing towards it through the dark water. I felt alone in a wonderful world. Wrapped in a strange peace, I stood there, taking no heed of time, lost in a dream. And suddenly I had a curious, intimate premonition of danger. I had heard nothing, but I swung round instinctively. A shadowy form had crept up behind me. As I turned, it sprang. One hand gripped my throat, stifling any cry I might have uttered. I fought desperately, but I had no chance. I was half choking from the grip on my throat, but I bit and clung and scratched in the most approved feminine fashion. The man was handicapped by having to keep me from crying out. If he'd succeeded in reaching me unawares, it would have been easy enough for him to sling me overboard with a sudden heave. The sharks would have taken care of the rest. Struggle as I would, I felt myself weakening. My assailant felt it too. He put out all his strength, and then, running on swift, noiseless feet, another shadow joined in. With one blow of his fist, he sent my opponent crashing headlong to the deck. Released, I fell back against the rail, sick and trembling. My rescuer turned to me with a quick movement. "You're hurt." There was something savage in his tone, a menace against the person who had dared to hurt me. Even before he spoke, I had recognized him. It was my man, the man with the scar. But that one moment in which his attention had been diverted to me had been enough for the fallen enemy. Quick as a flash, he'd risen to his feet and taken to his heels down the deck. With an oath, Rayburn sprang after him. I always hate being out of things. I joined the chase, a bad third. Round the deck we went to the starboard side of the ship. There by the saloon door lay the man in a crumpled heap. Rayburn was bending over him. "Did you hit him again?" I called breathlessly. "There was no need," he replied grimly. "I found him collapsed by the door. Or else he couldn't get it open and is shamming. We'll soon see about that. And we'll see who he is, too." With a beating heart, I drew near. I had realized at once that my assailant was a bigger man than Chichester. Anyway, Chichester was a flabby creature who might use a knife at a pinch, but who would have little strength in his bare hands. Rayburn struck a match. We both uttered an ejaculation. The man was Guy Paget. Rayburn appeared absolutely stupefied by the discovery. "Paget," he muttered. "My God, Paget? I felt a slight sense of superiority.
You seem surprised.
I am, he said heavily. I never suspected. He wheeled suddenly round on me.
And you?
You're not...
You recognized him, I suppose, when he attacked you.
No, I didn't. All the same, I'm not so very surprised. He stared at me suspiciously.
Where do you come in, I wonder? And how much do you know?
I smiled.
A good deal, Mr. Lucas.
He caught my arm. The unconscious strength of his grip made me wince.
Where did you get that name? He asked hoarsely.
Isn't it yours? I demanded sweetly. Or do you prefer to be called the man in the brown suit?
That did stagger him. He released my arm and fell back a pace or two.
Are you a girl or a witch? He breathed.
I'm a friend.
I advanced a step towards him. I offered you my help once. I offer it again. Will you have it?
The fierceness of his answer took me aback.
No, I'll have no truck with you or with any woman. Do your damnedest.
As before, my own temper began to rise.
Perhaps, I said, you don't realize how much in my power you are. A word from me to the captain?
Say it, he sneered.
Then advancing with a quick step, and while we're realizing things, my girl, do you realize that you're in my power this minute? I could take you by the throat like this.
With a swift gesture, he suited the action to the word. I felt his two hands clasp my throat and press, ever so little.
Like this, and squeeze the life out of you.
And then, like our unconscious friend here, but with more success, fling your dead body to the sharks. What do you say to that?
I said nothing. I laughed, and yet I knew that the danger was real.
Just at that moment, he hated me. But I knew that I loved the danger, loved the feeling of his hands on my throat, that I would not have exchanged that moment for any other moment in my life.
With a short laugh, he released me.
What's your name? He asked abruptly.
Anne Bedingfeld.
Does nothing frighten you, Anne Bedingfeld?
Oh, yes, I said, with an assumption of coolness I was far from feeling.
Wasps, sarcastic women, very young men, cockroaches, and superior shop assistants.
He gave the same short laugh as before. Then he stirred the unconscious form of Paget with his feet.
What shall we do with this junk?
Throw it overboard? He asked carelessly.
If you like, I answered with equal calm.
I admire your wholehearted, bloodthirsty instincts, Miss Bedingfeld, but we will leave him to recover at his leisure. He's not seriously hurt.
You shrink from a second murder, I see, I said sweetly.
A second murder?
He looked genuinely puzzled.
The woman at Marlowe, I reminded him, watching the effect of my words closely.
An ugly, brooding expression settled down on his face. He seemed to have forgotten my presence.
I might have killed her, he said.
Sometimes I believe that I meant to kill her.
A wild rush of feeling, hatred of the dead woman, surged through me.
I could have killed her that moment, had she stood before me. For he must have loved her once.
He must, to have felt like that.
I regained control of myself and spoke in my normal voice.
We seem to have said all there is to be said, except good night.
Good night and goodbye, Miss Bedingfeld.
Au revoir, Mr. Lucas.
Again he flinched at the name. He came nearer.
Why do you say that? Au revoir, I mean.
Because I have a fancy that we shall meet again.
Not if I can help it.
Emphatic as his tone was, it didn't offend me. On the contrary, I hugged myself with secret satisfaction. I'm not quite a fool.
All the same, I said gravely, I think we shall.
Why?
I shook my head, unable to explain the feeling that had actuated my words. "I never wish to see you again," he said suddenly and violently. It was really a very rude thing to say, but I only laughed softly and slipped away into the darkness. I heard him start after me and then pause, and a word floated down the deck. I think it was witch. Chapter 17. Extract from the diary of Sir Eustace Pedler. Mount Nelson Hotel, Cape Town. It is really the greatest relief to get off the Kilmorden. The whole time that I was on board, I was conscious of being surrounded by a network of intrigue. To put the lid on everything, Guy Paget must needs engage in a drunken brawl the last night. It's all very well to explain it away, but that is what it actually amounts to. What else would you think if a man comes to you with a lump the size of an egg on the side of his head and an eye colored all the tints of the rainbow? Of course, Paget would insist on trying to be mysterious about the whole thing. According to him, you'd think his black eye was the direct result of his devotion to my interests. His story was extraordinarily vague and rambling, and it was a long time before I could make head or tail out of it. To begin with, it appears he caught sight of a man behaving suspiciously. Those are Paget's words. He's taken them straight from the pages of a German spy story. What he means by a man behaving suspiciously, he doesn't know himself. I said so to him. He was slinking along in a very furtive manner, and it was the middle of the night, Sir Eustace. Well, what were you doing yourself? Why weren't you in bed and asleep like a good Christian? I demanded irritably. I'd been coding those cables of yours, Sir Eustace, and typing the diary up to date. Trust Paget to be always in the right, and a martyr over it. Well, I just thought I would have a look round before turning in, Sir Eustace. The man was coming down the passage from your cabin. I thought at once there was something wrong by the way he looked about him. He slunk up the stairs by the saloon. I followed him. My dear Paget, I said, why shouldn't the poor chap go on deck without having his footsteps dogged? Lots of people even sleep on deck. Very uncomfortable, I've always thought. The sailors wash you down with the rest of the deck at 5 in the morning. I shuddered at the idea. Anyway, I continued, if you went worrying some poor devil who was suffering from insomnia, I don't wonder he landed you one. Paget looked patient. If you would hear me out, Sir Eustace, I was convinced the man had been prowling about near your cabin, where he had no business to be. The only two cabins down that passage are yours and Colonel Race's. Race, I said, lighting a cigar carefully, can look after himself without your assistance, Paget. I added as an afterthought, so can I. Paget came nearer and breathed heavily, as he always does before imparting a secret. You see, Sir Eustace, I fancied, and now indeed I'm sure, it was Rayburn.
Rayburn?
Yes, Sir Eustace. I shook my head. Rayburn has far too much sense to attempt to wake me up in the middle of the night. Quite so, Sir Eustace. I think it was Colonel Race he went to see. A secret meeting. For orders. Don't hiss at me, Paget, I said, drawing back a little. And do control your breathing. Your idea is absurd. Why should they want to have a secret meeting in the middle of the night? If they'd anything to say to each other, they could hobnob over beef tea in a perfectly casual and natural manner. I could see that Paget was not in the least convinced. Something was going on last night, Sir Eustace, he urged. Or why should Rayburn assault me so brutally? You're quite sure it was Rayburn? Paget appeared to be perfectly convinced of that. It was the only part of the story that he wasn't vague about. There's something very queer about all this, he said. To begin with, where is Rayburn? It's perfectly true that we haven't seen the fellow since we came on shore. He didn't come up to the hotel with us. I decline to believe that he's afraid of Paget, however. Altogether, the whole thing's very annoying. One of my secretaries has vanished into the blue, and the other looks like a disreputable prize fighter. I can't take him about with me in his present condition. I shall be the laughingstock of Cape Town. I have an appointment later in the day to deliver old Milray's billet doux, but I shall not take Paget with me. Confound the fellow and his prowling ways. Altogether, I'm decidedly out of temper. I had poisonous breakfast with poisonous people. Dutch waitresses with thick ankles who took half an hour to bring me a bad bit of fish. And this farce of getting up at 5 a.m. on arrival at the port to see a blinking doctor and hold your hands above your head simply makes me tired. Later. A very serious thing has occurred. I went to my appointment with the Prime Minister, taking Milray's sealed letter. It didn't look as though it had been tampered with, but inside was a blank sheet of paper. Now, I suppose I'm in a devil of a mess. Why I ever let that bleeding old fool Milray embroil me in the matter, I can't think. Paget is a famous Job's comforter. He displays a certain gloomy satisfaction that maddens me. Also, he has taken advantage of my perturbation to saddle me with the stationery trunk. Unless he's careful, the next funeral he attends will be his own. However, in the end, I had to listen to him. Supposing, Sir Eustace, that Raeburn had overheard a word or two of your conversation with Mr. Milray in the street. Remember, you had no written authority from Mr. Milray. You accepted Raeburn on his own valuation. You think Raeburn is a crook, then? I said slowly. Paget did. How far his views were influenced by resentment over his black eye, I don't know. He made out a pretty fair case against Raeburn, and the appearance of the latter told against him. My idea was to do nothing in the matter. A man who has permitted himself to be made a thorough fool of is not anxious to broadcast the fact. But Paget, his energy unimpaired by his recent misfortunes, was all for vigorous measures. He had his way, of course. He bustled out to the police station, sent innumerable cables, and brought a herd of English and Dutch officials to drink whiskies and sodas at my expense. We got Milray's answer that evening. He knew nothing of my late secretary. There was only one spot of comfort to be extracted from the situation. At any rate, I said to Paget, you weren't poisoned. You had one of your ordinary bilious attacks. I saw him wince. It was my only score. Later. Paget is in his element. His brain positively scintillates with bright ideas. He will have it now that Raeburn is none other than the famous man in the brown suit. I dare say he's right. He usually is. But all this is getting unpleasant. The sooner I get off to Rhodesia, the better. I've explained to Paget that he's not to accompany me. You see, my dear fellow, I said, you must remain here on the spot. You might be required to identify Raeburn any minute. And besides, I have my dignity as an English Member of Parliament to think of. I can't go about with a secretary who's apparently recently been indulging in a vulgar street brawl. Paget winced. He's such a respectable fellow that his appearance is pain and tribulation to him. But what will you do about your correspondence and the notes for your speeches, Sir Eustace? I shall manage, I said airily. Your private car is to be attached to the 11 o'clock train tomorrow, Wednesday morning, Paget continued. I've made all arrangements. Is Mrs. Blair taking a maid with her? Mrs. Blair? I gasped. She tells me you offered her a place. So I did, now I come to think of it, on the night of the fancy dress ball. I even urged her to come, but I never thought she would. Delightful as she is, I don't know that I want Mrs. Blair's society all the way to Rhodesia and back. Women require such a lot of attention, and they're confoundedly in the way sometimes.
Have I asked anyone else? I said nervously.
One does these things in moments of expansion.
Mrs. Blair seemed to think you'd ask Colonel Race as well.
I groaned. I must have been very drunk if I asked Race.
Very drunk indeed.
Take my advice, Paget, and let your black eye be a warning to you. Don't go on the bust again.
As you know, I'm a teetotaler, Sir Eustace.
Much wiser to take the pledge if you have a weakness that way.
I haven't asked anyone else, have I, Paget?
Not that I know of, Sir Eustace.
I heaved a sigh of relief.
There's Miss Bedingfeld, I said thoughtfully. She wants to get to Rhodesia to dig up bones, I believe. I've a good mind to offer her a temporary job as a secretary. She can typewrite, I know, for she told me so.
To my surprise, Paget opposed the idea vehemently. He doesn't like Anne Bedingfeld. Ever since the night of the black eye, he has displayed uncontrollable emotion whenever she's mentioned.
Paget is full of mysteries nowadays.
Just to annoy him, I shall ask the girl. As I said before, she has extremely nice legs.